Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit BetterHelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Papa, dürfen wir?
Ich bin noch nicht fertig.
Und jetzt?
Sekündchen.
Oh, Papa!
Nein, dauert noch.
Also, bei Onkel Rudi ist immer schon gemäht.
Mit Mähen fertig sein, bevor die Kids spielen wollen? Damit's funktioniert, Husqvarna. Erstelle mit der Connect-App eigene Routinen. So ist dein Husqvarna-Mähroboter fertig, bevor deine Kids in den Garten wollen. Entdecke jetzt echte Innovation und Aktionsangebote für Mähroboter auf husqvarna.de oder bei deinem Husqvarna-Fachhändler. Get it right. Husqvarna.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're talking about a new report alleging that Egypt is denying Sudanese refugees the right to seek asylum.
We face deportation for the smallest infractions, stories of families being evicted from their homes, unable to afford school fees, and forbidden from working. But what choice do we have? Staying in Sudan means facing death by violence or starvation.
There has been an increase in violence in northern Mozambique, so why is a regional force to protect civilians withdrawing from the region? And why is a musical genre being blamed for a rise in gang violence in Lesotho?
The artists of this music have divided themselves into groups and they are brutally killing each other. Last month, five people shot dead from one family in Berea district. Someone has been shot in his business.
It's Wednesday, the 19th of June. First, we go to Cairo. Amnesty International is calling on Egypt to stop arresting Sudanese people seeking refuge from the war in their country. The Human Rights Watchdog says Cairo must stop sending refugees back to the conflict in neighboring Sudan. These calls are contained in a new report titled Handcuffed Like Dangerous Criminals. Now, we all know Sudan has been engulfed in violence between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces for more than a year now. Sending people back into the teeth of a vicious conflict is a violation of international law. The Amnesty report details the experiences of at least 27 Sudanese refugees who were arrested between October last year and March this year by the Egyptian Border Guard. According to the report, at least 800 people were denied the right to claim asylum earlier this year. Here's an extract from that report.
It is unfathomable that Sudanese women, men and children fleeing the armed conflict in their country and seeking safety across the border into Egypt are being rounded up en masse and arbitrarily detained in deplorable and inhumane conditions before being unlawfully deported. Egyptian authorities must immediately end this virulent campaign of mass arrests and collective expulsions. They must abide by their obligations under international human rights and refugee law to provide those fleeing the conflict in Sudan with safe and dignified passage to Egypt and unrestricted access to asylum procedures.
The report is based on interviews with detained refugees, their relatives, community leaders, lawyers, and a medical professional, as well as a review of official statements and documents and audiovisual evidence. This is a letter from someone seeking refuge in Egypt. We won't identify them for their own safety.
Life for Sudanese people is unbearably hard. Your financial situation and residency status heavily influence your chances of getting a visa to Egypt to escape the war. The visa we receive is tourist visa, requiring renewal every 3 months and offering no right to travel, losing it if we attempt to leave. We are not allowed to work, so it's not true residency. The economic situation in Egypt has spiraled, with inflation and Egyptian pounds devaluation impacting both locals and Sudanese refugees. Daily life has become a struggle for money. But for us, the Sudanese refugees, it's a constant nightmare. We face deportation for the smallest infractions. Stories of families being evicted from their homes, unable to afford school fees for children, and forbidden from working. Many of us has been forced to resort to smuggling to enter Egypt as visas are no longer being issued. The journey is very dangerous. And with the extreme heat, there are reports of many dying from sunstroke and dehydration. But what choice do we have? Staying in Sudan means facing death by violence or starvation, and no neighboring country offers true safety. We are trapped with no place to go.
Let's find out more now from my colleague Sally Nabil, who is in Cairo.
Sally, we haven't spoken for a while. How is Cairo these days?
Very hot. Very hot. It's 40 degrees here.
Is it hotter than it normally is this time of the year?
Yeah, much hotter.
Oh.
I've just made a story for Arabic how the uprooting of trees have contributed to the rise in temperature because the government has chopped down hundreds of trees all over the country. Right in front of our office, they have chopped down at least 20 trees. Some of them are 200 years old.
I can't even fathom.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we're going to get a bit more dispirited about this. So I'll start the interview now, Sally. Tell us about this Amnesty International report. It is called Handcuffed Like Dangerous Criminals, and it's about Sudanese refugees rounded up and unlawfully deported back to Sudan, which is a war zone.
Absolutely. I mean, the report has really harrowing details about how the Sudanese are being treated across the Egyptian-Sudanese borders, and many of them have crossed into the Egyptian side of the border illegally as they were fleeing the war that has been going on for more than a year. The report has been speaking about mass expulsions carried out by the Egyptian authorities against those Sudanese refugees, denying them access to asylum-seeking procedures and detaining them in really inhumane facilities that lack sanitation and the very basic hygiene standards and denying them health care. And it has quoted the UNHCR, which is the High Commission for Refugees, that 3,000 people were deported to Sudan from Egypt last September, which is quite a huge number, actually. It said that they should be given the opportunity to apply for asylum in Egypt because they don't have any other chance. And the fact that many Sudanese have chosen to cross into the Egyptian territory through an illegal path can be partially attributed to the fact that Egypt has imposed more restrictions on the visa application process.
Is this the way that people seeking refuge fleeing from war in Sudan are being treated across the country, wherever they are, or as the Amnesty report seems to be focusing on, mainly in the capital, Cairo?
Just to give our audience an idea about the route between Egypt and Sudan, most of them cross into the Egyptian side of the border via the border crossing, which is in southern Egypt. So some of the arrests have been made there across the border, and other arrests were made in the capital, Cairo, and its outskirts. So it's not just in Cairo, it's across the borders too. And one of the most striking details, really, is that there were a few Sudanese that were receiving treatment for injuries they have sustained on the way because of road accidents. And Egyptian authorities arrested them from inside hospitals before they fully recovered and against medical advice. This is what the Amnesty report says. And apparently they have been detained in some facilities that do not fit their medical condition at all. The report have been picturing how unhealthy the facilities are. Some of them had rats. They haven't been given due medical care. So it's a very grim picture for the situation in Egypt, actually.
But the Sudanese refugees and Sudanese people have been part of Egypt for decades. So what's changed and why has it changed in the way that they're being treated? Or have they always been treated badly and now we're just seeing it more overtly?
Actually, I've met some of the Sudanese who fled into Egypt right after the war, and some of them have really complained about the way they are being treated in some of the Egyptian neighborhoods. They have been subjected to various forms of racism from their Egyptian neighbors. But that lies in contradiction with the fact that the Sudanese community in Egypt is probably the largest community outside of Sudan. Millions of Sudanese have been coming to Egypt over the past decades or so. Probably this is why many of them choose to come to Egypt, not only because it's their neighbor from a geographical perspective, but also because there is a large Sudanese community that can make them feel at home here. Yet, we have heard really a lot of complaints about various forms of racism and discrimination. The people feel pretty uncomfortable. And I think that the new visa restrictions that Egyptians have introduced after the war pushed many Sudanese to take the illegal route of crossing into the country so that they won't have to wait for months to get a visa. And that has kind of exacerbated the mistreatment they have been subjected to.
Has the Egyptian government reacted to this report in any way yet?
No, and Amnesty International said they have contacted the authorities and they haven't heard from them. But the National Human Rights Council denied these accusations, saying that Egypt is abiding by the international law. But this reply, again, there are a lot of suspicions about it. And just a few days ago, there was a huge incident here that attracted a lot of attention. We are experiencing an exceptional heat wave in Egypt these days. And because of that, a lot of Sudanese who are stranded across the borders and who are making their way through the desert road have died of dehydration. And because of exceptionally strong heat wave we are experiencing nowadays.
Now, Egypt, on the other side of the country, also shares a border with Gaza, where also people are in crisis. Are there refugees coming from that side as well?
That's another story, actually, because what's common between both stories is that Egypt, this country, has overstretched resources. Egyptians are suffering on so many levels from an economic perspective, a logistic perspective. So the fact that it is already hosting refugees coming from the southern border of Sudan and the eastern border from Gaza, many people here believe that this will put extra pressure on the resources of the country that are already overstretched.
Do Palestinian refugees suffer the same fate as Sudanese refugees in Egypt? Are they also treated badly? Are they also detained and arrested and kept in conditions that are unsuitable for human beings from what you were describing to us earlier?
We haven't heard about that in human rights reports so far, but we know that they have to wait for long on the borders, but not as tragic as what we've read in the Amnesty report detailing the mistreatment the Sudanese are being subjected to.
What are the international legal positions that all countries have to adhere to when they're dealing with refugees that come from war situations?
First of all, to give them access to apply for asylum, to contact UNHCR, to have a chance to be legalized and have a legal status within the country as a refugee. You do have rights, you do have a financial allowance, even if it is not much, but at least you are within the legal framework. If you're being denied access to apply for asylum, so you are staying in the country illegal, and that gives the authorities an excuse to expel you. And then fleeing a war zone obliges the country that you're fleeing to provide you with safe haven. This is exactly what Amnesty International is talking about in its latest report. The Sudanese people are fleeing a vicious war in Sudan that have claimed so many lives. And they are being denied access to the asylum process, and they are being denied a safe haven as well.
That's the BBC's Sally Nabil in Cairo.
Northern Mozambique is at a crossroads right now as we consider the fact that an Islamist insurgency has wrecked Cabo Delgado province for the last 7 years. On the one hand, Ansar al-Sunnah, more popularly known as al-Shabaab, has continued to attack government targets and civilians in a conflict that began in 2017. On the other hand, a military force from the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, is about to withdraw the troops it had sent to the oil-rich district of Cabo Delgado. Oil and gas rigs had just been set up when the insurgency began, culminating in a massive attack on the city of Palma in the province back in 2021. It's not been safe ever since, even though Rwanda sent in forces, as well as the European Union. The Mozambican government even called on the Russian-affiliated Wagner Group to help regain control of the region. So why is the SADC force being disbanded? Ian Wafula is the BBC's Africa security correspondent, and he's been investigating the recent rise in violence in Cabo Delgado and the realignment of troops in the province.
Leading up to December 2023, the security situation in northern Mozambique had improved. However, since then there has been a spike in attacks in certain towns and villages within Cabo Delgado province, which is in the north of the country. Since then, we've had huge concern that it appears that the militant group that is Al-Shabaab, not the one linked to Somalia, is actually very determined to rebuild itself. And I say this because experts I've spoken to, including those from Human Rights Watch, say that they have seen young fighters or children being recruited into the ranks of these militants, just to show you that the militant group is very determined to kind of exploit the exit of the SADC forces. The SADC troops said they would exit the country by the 15th of July. So since then, we're looking at about more than 100,000 people who've been displaced, and this is the highest number of people who've been displaced in the last 2 years, according to humanitarian organizations. So a clear indication that the situation is almost going back to what it used to be about 7 years ago.
Now, you've been speaking to some of the people who are caught up in the violence and some of the people that have been displaced quite recently. What have they been telling you?
I mean, most of them just recall the horrors when you can imagine just waking up at about 4 a.m. to the sound of gunfire within the village or your locality, and then you have to run out of your house just for safety. So these are the kind of stories we're hearing. I spoke to one person by the name Thomas. He is a government official, and he was fortunate enough to be able to escape from the gunmen. He was afraid of his life. He said that should they have found out that he was a government official, they could have even beheaded him, as has been in the past, where these militants come into town and they shoot aimlessly and they torture the local population, and especially those who are seen to either work with government forces or even the government itself. Right now, the town of Macomia, life has not gone back to normal. There's been no electricity, medical facilities were interrupted. The local humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders said that they had to close down their operations because some of their staff were there when the attacks happened, and their hospital facilities were also raided. And in fact, the militants took away not only medication, but also some of the vehicles belonging to MSF. And so they had to relocate some of their stuff. So Macomia at the moment, it's not life as usual. In fact, people are living in fear that these militants could come back at any time.
And of course, we reported not so long ago about children being taken away as the organization, in a sense, replenishes its ranks, right?
Yes. Interestingly, this confirmation has also come from government. About 2 months ago, the president, Filipe Nyusi, said that part of the Mozambican army actually stopped an attack where gunmen had raided a town and they were trying to capture or kidnap the children in the town to kind of recruit them into the ranks. And then we saw an interesting report coming from Human Rights Watch, which said that two members of a family literally saw their 13-year-old looting and fighting amongst the militants. And this is in the attack that happened on the 10th of May, which has been described as the biggest attack this year when the government took control of the town for 2 years. So there's huge concern that indeed these children are being recruited into the ranks, and a clear indication that the militants are trying to regroup themselves.
And yet, troops that were in the country from neighboring countries are now planning on withdrawing. Can you explain to us, firstly, which countries had actually contributed troops, and then tell us why they are withdrawing at this delicate, critical junction?
Yes, so we had members of the SADC forces. So we're looking at South Africa, Tanzania, Botswana, Angola, Lesotho, kind of withdrawing their troops, because a statement that I read on their website about 2 weeks ago, this was at the time when Botswana was withdrawing its contingent, it said that they were confident that they had achieved what their mandate was, and that was to restore peace and security in the Cabo Delgado region in the north of Mozambique. So according to them, they feel as though they have achieved what they needed to have done. But at this point, I do not think they had expected that the militants would kind of come out of the bush, for lack of a better word. So we did have South Africa, which is the largest contributor towards this mission, with about more than 1,000 troops, say that they will actually let their troops stay in the country, but they would not stay under the SADC agreement. Tanzania, on the other hand, apparently has decided to keep its 300 troops just because they border Mozambique to the north, and that is on the Cabo Delgado province. Previously, we've seen cases of attacks on this borderline. And so authorities in Tanzania are concerned that with the withdrawal of the SADC forces, then Tanzania could be left vulnerable. Speaking to also analysts, they say that the reason why SADC is withdrawing its forces is mainly two reasons. One, they remain underfunded, especially for this particular mission, since they rely on contribution from member countries. Second, SADC as a regional body has decided to change its priority and focus on the stabilization of the DRC. Back in December last year, they took about 2,000 of their troops to the DRC. And now analysts are saying that the focus has shifted, which is part of the reason why they're withdrawing from Mozambique. It is obvious of concern that, you know, the militants are keen to exploit these gaps being left by the SADC forces, because if Botswana, Angola and Lesotho are withdrawing their troops, then it means the numbers of troops kind of sent to stabilize the north of Mozambique has reduced. And so this might create the gaps. Analysts are concerned that it is too early for the SADC forces to withdraw from the country. Even though Rwanda has said that it will send in additional 2,000 forces, they still feel that this is not enough, especially given that over the last few months, it's been clear that the militants are very determined to take advantage or to exploit the exit of the SADC forces.
And it seems like they've got room to do that, and they've been emboldened by these moves. But everybody says that all wars end not with the war continuing, but with negotiations and with other solutions rather than military solutions. Are there suggestions as to how this insurgency can actually be addressed long term?
Yeah, in fact, some of the analysts were making a good point, and they were arguing that the Mozambican army needs to be strengthened further. They need, you know, further capacity building. They need better equipment. Their welfare needs to be looked after. And one of them alluded to the fact that most of the troops from the Mozambican army are not from the north, and so they do not relate to the issues that are coming from that particular end, and so they might not be fully aware of the situation. But they also said that, yeah, the army needs further bolstering and support from the government. That could be a military solution. And obviously, they emphasized that the SADC forces should not leave. They also welcomed the decision by Rwanda to send in additional 2,000 troops.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's the BBC's Africa security correspondent, Ian Wafula. This is Focus in Africa from the BBC World Service.
Herbert, da hinten hast du noch was vergessen.
Ja.
Bisschen noch?
Marianne.
Herbert, waren das meine Tulpen?
Nein.
Setz nicht auf Herbert, sondern auf deinen Mähroboter. Damit's funktioniert, Husqvarna. Perfekte Rasenkanten, so präzise wie noch nie. Mit den neuen EdgeCut-Modellen von Husqvarna. Entdecke jetzt echte Innovation und Aktionsangebote für Mähroboter auf husqvarna.de oder bei deinem Husqvarna-Fachhändler. Get it right. Husqvarna.
We're going to talk about Famu, a type of music from Lesotho, that country that is almost hidden within South Africa. Famu consists of singing and ululating, and it's accompanied by the accordion, a drum, and occasionally a bass. It flourished at a time when Basotho migrant workers on the mines in neighboring South Africa would sing and play to remind themselves of their homeland and to strengthen the ties between themselves. Here's a little taste of how it sounds. People across the country listen to Famu now.
but it has come to be associated with rising levels of gang violence. These gangs wear different colored blankets to distinguish themselves, much like gangster rap bands use different colors to identify themselves in the U.S. It has also come to be associated with political divisions in Lesotho. Rapaleng is a journalist from Lesotho. She gave us an insight into the recent violence.
The artists of this music have divided themselves into groups and they are brutally killing each other. In general, they are called Makhomosha in Sesotho language. They are illegally working in closed mines, South Africa. Still, we don't know the reason behind the killing. Last month, 5 people shot dead from one family. The following week, they shot almost 5 horses. Still don't know the reason. We don't know the people who are killing. In Berea district, someone has been shot in his business, and the people who were in that club, they got injured. They are badly in hospitals now as we speak.
So now, people are demanding that the government declare a state of emergency and to ban FAMO gangs. But how did a genre of music come to be associated with gang violence? And is it fair to pin these killings on the music? I've been speaking to Kananelo Buluetsi, a defender of the music, but no apologist for the social problems Lesotho faces. Lesotho has one of the highest murder rates in the world. For a small country, that's a lot. Kananelo and I began our conversation with him describing FAMO music. How are you?
I'm good, and you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us. What sort of music is it? What does it sound like? And what do they sing about traditionally?
It's sort of hip-hop or rap music. Different artists, you know, sing about different things. I cannot say particularly all FAMO artists sing about a certain issue.
But typically, what kind of things would they talk about in their lyrics?
Let me make an example. We had one artist who was called Famole. He will sing about the royal family. He will sing about our national football team. They sing about different issues.
And would you say that it enjoys popularity across the board, young and old, in Lesotho?
Yes, I've been listening to FAMO since I was young. I'm old now. I still listen to FAMO. I know a lot of people across different ages who listen to that music.
So your granny would listen to it as well?
My?
Your granny.
Yes, definitely.
Right.
My grandmother, she passed away, but then she was a principal in primary school. One of his students, he was called Mazie Sefadi. He became a FAMO artist, so my grandmother would enjoy listening to Mazie.
Right.
When he was still alive, and when my grandmother was still alive, yes.
I'm sorry to hear about your grandmother. So how then did FAMO become associated with gangs and violence and killings?
There were no gangs initially. But late, maybe early 2000s, some decided to form some groups. And when other groups came, there was competition between the groups. And that competition led to some violence.
And what was the competition about?
Initially, it was all about the market.
You mean fans?
Some groups came in.
People listening to the music?
Yes, yes. They were competing for fans.
So, I mean, people have been studying FAMO and the music and the association with violence for a while now. And one of the things, or some of the things that people talk about is the fact it began in the mines in South Africa. So it was firstly a form of association amongst Basotho on the mines in South Africa. Then gradually, when mining work became less formal, people started fragmenting into groups competing for space on the artisanal or illegal mining groups in South Africa. And then politicians came up and started getting affiliations to different FAMO groups as well.
You know, many Basotho men worked in the mines in South Africa. And for a fact that they were Basotho, they would listen to FAMO because that is their music. They listened to that music. So as time went on, we know many were retrenched from the mines. Some started mining illegally. And we know that they were fans of FAMO music. So we have people who are involved in illegal mining, not necessarily that they are FAMO artists or anything, but they are FAMO fans. Because generally, if you are from the Lesotho, you definitely listen to that genre of music.
I understand also that the groups, the FAMO groups that are associated with criminality have sort of different colored blankets that they use. And just to make people understand about the importance of blankets in Lesotho, Lesotho is quite cold. It's quite high up. It's mountainous. So people wear blankets to protect themselves. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, particularly in Mafeteng, the people in that district wore a yellow and black blanket. But when it became very associated with politics, the people who felt uncomfortable that terrain was now very associated with politics decided to form their own groups that would specifically be involved in music, because they were aggrieved that terrain had become so much associated with politics. So they founded other groups. And these groups would wear the blankets that we call matlama. I'm not sure how I can describe that blanket, but they would wear blankets called matlama.
What
some
colors
wore
are they?
Blankets. Matlama have different colors. Some are black, some are gray, some are red. There are various colors.
Right. Now, the government has decided to declare a state of emergency because of violence sort of spiking around gangs. Can you just give us a taste of some of the things that have been happening recently, some of the violence that led to this point?
Maybe I should mention that there is no state of emergency at all. What the government has done is to declare these groups as unlawful.
But there are calls for a state of emergency, right?
To deal with crime, rampant crime. Yes, there are some calls for state of emergency. But if you can recall, as recent as 2022, there was a state of emergency declared in Lesotho, and some people went to court. And the High Court clarified under which circumstances can a state of emergency be declared. And crime, like ordinary crime, as we can see now, is not one of the reasons that can lead to a state of emergency. This has been discussed. I think that's why the government then decided to only declare these groups as illegal, because it's very difficult to go the state of emergency road, because this crime has been here for a very long time now.
But there have also been calls for FAMO gangs to be banned.
Yes, because the government has actually declared a legal notice declaring those groups as unlawful, meaning they have been banned, they have been prohibited. They can no longer operate legally in the country.
I get the feeling that you feel that it's unfair for the government and people to associate FAMO with criminality and gangsterism.
Yes, I think it's unfair.
But it has happened, right? That there are FAMO music groups that are associated in this way. So can we talk about some of the incidents that have led to this connection?
Let me make an example. We have some people who are called Zulus living in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. Those guys have their own genre of music that they listen to. And there are so many crimes happening in KwaZulu-Natal, some committed by Zulus. And these people listen to their own genre of music. Nobody has decided or suggested that Zulus commit crimes because they listen to a particular genre of music. Nobody has said that. It's only in the Lesotho where they will say, okay, these guys are criminals. Which music do they listen to? I don't know, it's FAMO. Then they decide to say, okay, we're going to ban FAMO because these guys listen to that music. But I think we have criminals who listen to almost every genre of music. But no one has ever decided to say, okay, because this guy is a criminal, let's check what kind of music he listens to so that we can ban that music.
Okay, I'm not going to argue with you about the particularities around music being associated with gangsterism and whether it's fair or not fair. What I will say is that there are musical genres that are associated with criminality. Your government has done it.
Yes.
Rap music in the US was similarly stigmatized. And there were reasons why that would happen, whether they were fair or not. So in particular with this case, the government of Lesotho has decided that this is a problem. Are you saying that they're wrong in doing that?
I have statistics of criminal cases that were reported to the police over the years. The latest information we have is that of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
I think murder comes on the list of serious crimes that Lesotho commit. As you can see now, because politicians have involved themselves into FAMO music, it's being used in some cases as a scapegoat. People will say Lesotho has a problem of murder, and I agree with that. But when you check the districts, which have the highest number of murders committed in a particular year, you'll find that these districts have nothing to do with that music. Maybe we should not take what politicians say as it is, but look on the facts. Like I said, farmer groups are associated now with opposition political parties. Some people see what government has done as something that's directly directed to the opposition parties. Some people say, no, this is not to fight crime, but this is an attack on the political parties that have some affiliations with these farmer groups.
Right. Now, in 2016, the government then formed a task team to investigate matters surrounding murders by farmer gangs. There were six other political parties involved in that as well. They clearly seem to have a strong view that FAMO-related gangs are driving some crime in Lesotho, enough for them to try and take action against it. Are you downplaying the issue because you don't want people to take away the wrong impression of the music, but actually other people in Lesotho regard it as a particular problem and they want something done about the problem because crime is crime and murder is, and I appreciate, I fully take on board what you said about murder rates in areas where, you know, you don't find FAMO issues in particular. But I'm just wondering whether it is an issue, but you're downplaying it because you don't want to cement that connection.
Not necessarily. I admit that we have a problem of murder in Lesotho, and this is public information. We can go anywhere, we can check any statistics, we'll find that Lesotho has one of the highest homicide rates. But what I'm trying to say is that this is mainly caused by socioeconomic factors more than music itself. What we are calling violence now is not violence related to music as such, but it's violence related to illegal activities that these people are involved in South Africa. Because we find that someone, okay, was killed in South Africa, his friends will come to Lesotho to revenge and they will kill the family of whoever they think killed their friends over illegal mining in South Africa. So I'm saying the issue is that since Basotho are now not working in South African mines legally anymore, they have decided to work illegally. They commit crimes, they kill each other, and it happens that they are fans of farming music. This is a socio-economic issue more than a music issue.
That's the journalist Kananelo Muluwetsi in Lesotho. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan, Patricia Whitehorn and Rob Wilson. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Jonathan Greer was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thanks for listening. Till we meet again.
Schatz, wir müssen los zu meiner Mutter.
Oh, ich kann leider nicht mit. Der Mähroboter mäht immer noch nicht, wo er soll.
Immer findest du eine Ausrede.
Ja, nein, das ist nicht so leicht.
Sonst läuft bei dir doch auch alles automatisch. Weniger Ausreden, mehr Automatisierung. Damit's funktioniert, Husqvarna. Stimme deinen Husqvarna-Mähroboter durch individuelle Installation exakt auf deine Anforderungen ab. Entdecke jetzt echte Innovation und Aktionsangebote für Mähroboter auf husqvarna.de oder bei deinem Husqvarna-Fachhändler. Get it right. Husqvarna.